I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Carolyn Cusin Pritchard, author of the new children's book, Giddy and Kvetch, that teaches Yiddish to kids. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. This week we begin the Jewish calendar month of Elul, last month of the year, when we prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish days of Avodah, Yamim Noraim, the High Holy Days. Beginning 3 weeks or so from now, Rosh Hashanah starts Monday night, September 6th. The word Elul, the name of this month, is made up of four Hebrew letters, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. In a beautiful interpretation, these stand for the words Ani ledodi vedodi li, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. A passage from the beautiful biblical book, The Song of Songs, teaching us that at this time of year, God seeks to unify with us, to renew the bonds of love and tenderness that come during this period of return and renewal. To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of the month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, and to apologize to those we've wronged or injured. Blowing shofar is a great way to wake people up. A shofar, of course, is a ram's horn, hollowed out. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own. With a bit of practice, you too can learn to blow the shofar. Our school children in our congregation Beit Simcha Religious School all learn to blow the shofar. You could too. It's a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days, an ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. I just happened to bring a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us in on this Two Jewish radio show. I can actually hold that last Kia Gadola a lot longer, but, you know, it's a waste of airtime, to be frank. Anyway, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you surely should be by now. To play us in this morning, a little differently, on the same theme of the shofar, we begin with a setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tika B'Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty, gathering our exiles from the four corners of the earth, perhaps even to return to temple for services on Rosh Hashanah. This is a highly idiosyncratic version by the Diaspora Collection Yeshiva Band, kind of a countrified setting of Tika B'Shofar that I promise you will definitely not hear in the synagogue this year. Tika B'Shofar Gadol L'Cherutenu V'Sanes L'Kabetz Giluyotenu Tika B'Shofar Gadol L'Cherutenu V'Sanes L'Kabetz Giluyotenu V'Kabzenu Yachad Me'ar B'Kanfot Me'ar B'Kanfot Haaretz Le'Yartzenu. Thank you. That was Tekaba Shofar for the coming High Holy Days, the season of the shofar, as it could have been performed in the mountains of North Carolina or Tennessee, maybe, from the Diaspora Collection Yeshiva Band. When we come back on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Carolyn Cusin Pritchard, author of the new children's book, Giddy and Kvetch, will tell us why it's important these days to teach Yiddish to kids. Find out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue, well, newish, in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, high holy day services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning by emailing me, rabbi at beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. You can also join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them, preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We will continue to hold our services both live and with full music by virtual experience, in person, and also on Facebook Live. All of our Adult Education Academy classes and our outreach classes are live and on Zoom. You can access that by emailing rabbi at beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tykes program are available in person and on Zoom in blended format. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, life cycles, ceremonies, rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services on Facebook, go to BEITSIMCHATucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Caroline Cusin Pritchard is the author of a charming new kids book, which introduces kids to Yiddish, really. It's Giddy and Kvetch, and we'll hear about the naming and all the rest of it in just a moment. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so why a book teaching young kids Yiddish now?
That's the question. I think I should probably rewind then and explain the inspiration behind the story, if that's okay.
Even better. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So, you know, my grandfather actually passed away months before writing the story, and he is for certain the inspiration behind it, and that he was just this larger-than-life man. He was an enthusiast to the nth degree, and, you know, everything was fabulous and wonderful and awful. Any emotion was hyperbolous. And for me growing up, his use of Yiddish kind of captured some of that energy. His way of talking and engaging felt so visceral. It was such this emotional, rich way of connecting to the world. So for me, in my own identity and Jewish identity, Yiddish feels so intrinsically connected to that. And so in his passing and processing that grief and what he meant to me, the stories that were flowing out of me just had that Yiddish. It was just there. There was no why. It was just part of my memory of him. And so I thought, if I'm going to write a story, and then so many were coming out that has to do with his spirit, then Yiddish is going to be core to that. So that was one piece of it. And the second is just this idea that, you know, when you think about Jewish picture books that are on the shelf today, and what you can find if you walk into, whether it's a Barnes & Noble or an indie, that limited selection is pretty focused on food and holidays. Like, those are right. Pretty much what you're going to get when you
lots of Hanukkah books, a couple of Pesach books, Purim, and then something about gefilte fish.
And there's probably gefilte fish. You got it. And so for me, I have 3 kids, 4 and under. And while those are all
relevant
and special, I know.
Are you sure you're not ultra-Orthodox? I'm sorry. I have to ask.
I'm not. I'm just out of my mind, as it turns out.
I'll bet.
Yeah, so when I was thinking about picture books for them and kind of raising them in, you know, Judaism or being in their Jewishness, all those books were wonderful, but none of them really captured what it felt like for me to grow up being Jewish in my family. And so I'm just hoping that a book like this can add to that conversation in a way that I hadn't seen entirely yet.
It's a great answer, much better than the question I asked, although I'll come back to that. We will return in just a moment with Caroline Cusin Pritchard talking about her book, Gideon Kvetch, in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us to TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's very popular podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We are delighted to welcome our very special expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Try to vary my introductions a little in this
great
next year of Too Jewish. I just came back from Rome a little while ago. Part of my honeymoon was Sophia. I had a wonderful time. Had a great tour of Jewish Rome, which I've visited many times, but she had not. You know, such an interesting, diverse, rich community going back to Maccabean times, you know, 2nd century BCE, been there ever since. I think my insight, what was different this time, was some small things that this woman, Michaela Pavancella, showed us about the ghetto area of Rome. You know, there's like a place where the gate used to be between the Christian and ghetto itself. And you can see the height of the roof, of the floors is much lower in the ghetto, right? Because they had to have so many more people crammed in there. Mm-hmm. You know, little stuff like that that you don't notice. You can still see where the gate was affixed. Obviously, there's no gates anymore. And she talked about how the Germans brought their trucks, you know, right to the edge of the street. And you can see how that was possible because there was no place to go.
Right.
The other part was noting that the ghetto area, which was started in the 16th century, was chosen because the Tiber used to flood every year, and that was an undesirable area.
Right.
Well, it ain't an undesirable area now. It's become very gentrified, and they're fixing up everything. They're always fixing up everything in Italy, but what's the phrase that you
Lavori in corso.
Which
works
means
in
like
progress.
Works in progress, which is the whole country, feels like a lot of times. I just found it really interesting. There's other new kind of architectural feature. I mean, you know, if you see the Great Synagogue, a lot of the stuff I've seen many times, but the fountain that was built, I think it's designed by Bernini, that's just outside the ghetto. With, I think it's a dolphin fountain or something. It's really, or turtle fountain. It's really cool. And
like a little tiny park.
A kind of a mini square, right? A little mini piazza. And they said that was so that the ghetto could have fresh water because they didn't have any, like that. Designed by Bernini, the same guy who, you know, this fantastic architect and
Sculptor.
The sculptor who created the in St. Peter's that fantastic, I don't remember what it's even called, that piece in the middle of St. Peter's that's so beautifully designed. Anyway, just so many interesting, there's always some little tidbit, right? Something you didn't know about.
Right. Well, I think one of the interesting things, first of all, that great synagogue is magnificent, and it could only be built after Rome was no longer under the direct control of the church. Once Italy gained its independence and became a secular country, Jews could raise money and build a synagogue that was higher than other buildings around it.
Yeah.
Before that, there had been a prohibition against any Jewish building being high.
Right.
But the most interesting part of that synagogue, of course, is the museum in the basement, which is extensive and fabulous. And, you know, it's most of what's left of the Libyan Jewish community. They didn't all come to Rome, but a lot of their stuff did. And it's an incredible collection. The one thing that I think few people other than you understand about the Roman Jewish community, the Italian Jewish community in general, is that it is neither Ashkenazic nor Sephardic. Yes, it's quite true that lots of Jews came to Italy and particularly to Rome as a result of the expulsion from Spain. And so right around the end of the 1400s, the early 1500s, a lot of Jews came from Spain and settled in Italy. And they are truly Sephardic. But as you pointed out before, there were 1,500 years of Jewish history before that in Italy. And the Italian Jews developed their own tunes, their own traditions, their own words for certain common prayers, like Chag Gadiah is a little bit different in Italian.
Right.
And it's one of the few examples where you don't have to look very far. You don't have to look to Afghanistan or Bukhara or Sudan or Ethiopia to find a Jewish community which is neither Sephardic nor Ashkenazic. And I am increasingly annoyed by the effects of the dumbing down of the American educational system are, among other things, that lots of younger Jews, people under 30 or 40, really do believe that every Jew in the world is either Ashkenazic or Sephardic, and you need look no further than Rome to prove the contrary.
Yeah, it's great. If they even know that there's a distinction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim among younger Jews, but let's leave that aside for another time. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An elderly Jewish man is in the hospital in Manhattan dying. His family gathers around. He tells his wife, "Sarah, when I die, I want you to have the townhomes on the west side." He calls over his son and says, "Jordan, after I'm gone, you get the office buildings downtown." Finally, he announces to his daughter, "Zelda, I pick you to have the apartment buildings on the south side." The nurse is quite impressed. She whispers to the wife, "Wow, your husband must be quite the real estate mogul." But the wife exclaims, "Mogul schmogul, the schmuck has a newspaper route." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You know, that joke is only going to last as long as printed newspapers do. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion that deals very directly with war, Ki Tetzeh. Most of us who feel positively about religion believe strongly nations should live at peace, that war will someday become an ancient bad memory. They shall beat swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall men learn war anymore, our prophet Isaiah predicted. And almost every religion has similar injunctions about peace. Isaiah predicted this great time of peace some 2,700 years ago, yet it still seems as elusive as ever. The historical truth of human civilization is that war is almost always going on somewhere and sometimes everywhere in the world, and that the number of years in which this planet has been free of war is very few indeed. One calculation says that out of the 3,400 years of recorded human history, only 250 years have been free of a documented war. That is, once every 15 years, we have a year without war. To be honest, that seems wildly optimistic. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a single year in which warfare has not been waged somewhere on this globe. Which makes the agenda of the opening section of our Parsha this week, Ki Teitzeh, sadly and strangely appropriate. For it does not begin Im Teitzeh LaMilchama, if you go out to war against your enemy, but Ki Teitzeh LaMilchama, when you go out to war against your enemy. Pragmatically, the Torah treats war as a tragic but inevitable result of human conflict. We hate war. We seek to avoid war at all costs. We know war is destructive to much of what we believe in and pray for. But we also know there are simply times when it cannot be avoided, when in our fallible human way we will fall into war. Perhaps the best translation might be when you must go out to war. There's an old platitude, all's fair in love and war, but Ki Teitzeh informs us that all is not fair in war, that we need to restrain ourselves both in our military conduct and in the ways in which we re-enter society. That restraint is essential to our moral claim to serve God through our own actions, to fight for the right. We are obligated to act in ways that sustain and reinforce holiness even under the exigencies of military necessity. And so our section of Deuteronomy scrupulously outlines the ways in which we must restrain ourselves when forced to engage in warfare. We are not to destroy the productive capacity of the land of our enemies, no salting the soil. We are not to exploit captives, women especially, as though they were subhuman. We are to have a cleansing process after battle before we re-engage in civilian society. A physical and psychological re-entry, giving us time to readapt to civilian life. The contemporary Israeli army, the IDF, has its own code of conduct, the Tohor HaNeshek, the purity of arms. This is a serious effort to reinterpret the concept of fighting only the right way into practical terms. When Israeli soldiers fail that test, they are held accountable by Israel's own society. This makes the accusations of Israel's enemies all the more ludicrous when they claim the Israeli army is less moral than its counterpart militaries. The truth is the opposite. Faced with a continually challenging set of situations, the IDF might be the most scrupulously policed army in the world. It is certainly not true that Israeli soldiers are perfect, for they, like all of us, are human and typically very young. Often placed in extremely challenging situations requiring decisions that can save or end their own lives and those of their comrades and fellow citizens. But Israeli soldiers are held accountable for their actions. They know it. They are trained to strive to act with appropriate restraint, even under severe duress. Perhaps the greatest lesson for those of us fortunate enough not to be engaged in military conflict is that if rules can be applied to the harshest form of interaction for humans, warfare, they can certainly be applied successfully to the lesser friction and sorus in human interactions we experience in our own daily lives. If our ancestors managed to avoid the worst excesses of warfare, perhaps we too can learn to avoid the worst excesses our society presents to us. The conflicts, arguments, and disputes that damage us, our society, those around us, and our world. Instead of plunging further into hostility, we can de-escalate conflict. Instead of engaging in hateful exchanges on social media, we can disengage. In place of doubling down on personal attacks or insults, we can demonstrate restraint, judgment, balance, wisdom. Perhaps then, free of these excesses of conflict and conduct, we can resume our real task, to create a world of holiness and blessing, in which someday Isaiah's great words about the ultimate end of war and a time of permanent peace may really come true. When we come back, our guest, Carolyn Cusin Pritchard, will share just why Yiddish matters for young kids today and why her book, Gideon Kvetch, is perfect for teaching them that. Find out when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The final totals for the Tokyo Olympics came in after last week's Too Jewish show, and we need to add that in addition to earlier bronze medals for Israel in mixed team judo and taekwondo by Avishag Semberg, plus a gold medal in gymnastics for Artem Dolgopiat, rhythmic gymnast Linoy Ashram won gold as well, the very first Israeli woman to win gold at the Olympics. That put Israel's total at an all-time high, 4 Olympic medals in 1 Olympics. In addition, U.S. Jewish athletes won a couple of other gold medals. Sue Bird of the U.S. women's basketball team won her 5th gold medal, going all the way back to the 2000 Olympics, a record she and teammate Diana Taurasi set for all-American basketball players. Jewish American Alex Kleinman won gold in women's beach volleyball with her partner April Ross, while Jessica Fox of Australia, probably the greatest woman paddler of all time, won both a bronze and finally an Olympic gold medal. Fox was the only athlete to medal in both canoe slalom and kayak slalom. Having finished a disappointing 3rd in the kayak race, she rallied for gold in a historic canoe event. First time women's canoe slalom has been contested at the Olympics. Jessica Fox had previously won 2 Olympic medals, a silver in 2012, a bronze in 2016. Her mom, Jewish Olympian Miriam Yerushalmi, won bronze at the 1996 Olympics in kayak slalom. Yerushalmi now coaches her daughter. And Russian Olympic Committee gymnast Lilia Akhimova won gold with Team Russia in the women's team gymnastics competition. Mazel tov to all the Jewish Olympians. And the answer is Mayim Bialik. Jeopardy! Is getting its first ever Jewish host. Sony Pictures Television announced actress Mayim Bialik will host the eternally running game show's new primetime specials, as well as Jeopardy! Spin-off shows like National College Championships. Following longtime host Alex Trebek's death last fall, Mayim Bialik served as one of the show's celebrity guest hosts for a couple of weeks in June. In her new role, the star of The Big Bang Theory will also host spin-off series, including a college tournament next year. Mike Richards, one of the show's executive producers, will host the daily syndicated episodes and produce the shows that Bialik hosts. Really, really honored and astounded and excited for this. It's beyond anything I ever imagined could happen, Bialik tweeted. Mayim Bialik holds a doctoral degree in neuroscience from UCLA, my own alma mater, and often writes about her observant Jewish practice. She will be the show's first permanent woman host. Mayim Bialik is a past guest of Too Jewish and came to Kabbalistic Shabbat services at my show once. She is an incredibly nice person, as well, of course, as being personally modern Orthodox. Bialik posted a video response to the news, paying tribute to her Jewish immigrant grandparents. I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge that I am a second-generation American and my grandparents were immigrants. My mother's parents, in particular, never had a command of the English language. It's a tremendously bizarre, humbling, and surreal experience to see that in the time that my grandparents fled Eastern Europe until now, how much has changed in my life, she said. Mazel tov, Mayim. In less happy news, a group of Orthodox Jewish girls were barred from boarding a flight from Amsterdam to New York one evening and then kicked off another flight the next day, according to their rabbi. The 18 teenagers, part of a group visiting religious sites in Ukraine, were initially disallowed from traveling on a flight home because of a dispute over COVID-19 protocols on the KLM-operated leg of their journey from Kiev to Amsterdam. Rabbi Yisrael Kahan said that a day later, Delta Airlines kicked the same girls off for swapping seats on a Friday morning flight. Kahan went on to level accusations of anti-Semitism about Delta's decisions. With anti-Semitism, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, then it probably is a duck. Apparently not a kosher duck. After the girls were barred from boarding the first flight, Kahan said, the group slept on benches at Amsterdam's airport while he and a chaperone tried to arrange journeys home. Kahan said he and another rabbi started calling New York lawmakers, including Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, to reach out to Delta to remedy the situation. Schumer apparently stepped in, well, at least is believed to have done so, the rabbi said, and Delta executives personally called the parents of the stranded girls and arranged a Delta flight from Amsterdam to New York the next morning. In the morning, the girls boarded the Delta flight to New York from Amsterdam, but Kahan said that as soon as they were on, they were asked to leave. 10 minutes later, the phone rings. He said they're being taken off the plane. The rabbi says one of the girls was asked to swap seats by a mother who wanted to be sitting next to her son. The minute they made the swap, a stewardess made a beeline to the girl and said, "You're misbehaving. You're kind of on thin ice. To begin with, get off the plane." A video appears to show a woman confirming she asked to switch seats, and this led to the girls being asked to leave the flight. Kahan said the girl returned to her assigned seat, but the whole group of teenagers was still told to leave. He said the woman was allowed to remain on the plane because it was her first transgression. The rabbi said he hated to throw the card out there, but nevertheless suspected anti-Semitism. "Either you're telling me that you know that each and every one of them was violating rules on both flights," Kahan added, "or you're telling me you banned the whole group, a group of one ethnicity, for this misbehavior." The girls were removed, booked onto a Delta flight later that day, but declined to travel on it, would have involved returning to their homes after the start of Shabbat. Instead, they spent the night in Antwerp, traveling home to New York with United on Sunday morning. A Delta representative said, "We apologize to our customers on Delta Flight 47, Amsterdam to New York JFK, who were delayed and inconvenienced to remove a group of passengers who refused to comply with crew instructions. The flight departed approximately 2 hours after its originally scheduled time." That might be less than a full explanation from Delta Airlines. Bad stuff. Doesn't speak well for the airline. And that's Too Jewish, and it's News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Caroline Cusin Pritchard, is the author of a charming new kids book called Gideon Kvetch, which I'm still waiting on the hardcover. I just have the electronic version, but it looks quite beautiful. And it helps to teach, well, actually, I was going to say two things. One is a little bit of Yiddish and also some emotional regulation. Is Yiddish inherently, do you think, a more emotional language?
What a question. I think for me, in my experience of it, yes. I mean, I think it's not just a word to fill in a definition. It's, for me, it paints a picture. My dad talks about, he grew up in Texarkana, Texas, a small town right on the border of Texas and Arkansas. And my grandfather, I mentioned earlier, they had a furniture store. And my dad described how, you know, you'd have to clean all the furniture ever since he was little. And he was like, it was never just grab a rag, use a rag to clean it. It was a shmata. And for him, that was just like, it's like these dirty rags that you had lying around. Rag didn't cut it, but shmata really cut it. Or, you know, any word you just pick, and there's a story behind it. And so for me, when you're storytelling, and certainly for kids, the words are exciting and loaded with history and family and connection. And so I think that's something special I really wanted to lean into.
Okay, so now you've explained sort of the origin of this and how it connects you to your youth. Mm-hmm. And your process of growing up, and I bet you use Yiddish words with your little kids now.
Oh, yes.
What does Yiddish add to the life of a Jewish kid or even a non-Jewish kid growing up now? What can it add?
Well, I think one piece, thinking about kind of a larger context of what it means to be Jewish, and certainly, you know, in the States, is
right.
I think it adds another facet of, you know, what is Jewish life? And Yiddish, of course, comes from an Ashkenazi background. It's just one piece. It's not shared across the board. But I think it opens up a conversation around, you know, Jewish people having a language and a history and a place that extends beyond maybe your local synagogue. It's a story, and it's rich in that way. And so for me, I think a lot of kids may not have even heard of Yiddish. And so then by seeing these words pop up, it opens up conversation and dialogue. And hopefully in many ways it's humanizing for Jewish kids and Jewish people.
The story itself is really charming. It highlights, I hope I'm not like spoiling it for anybody, but it highlights a very optimistic little girl and her very pessimistic friend, pet. How would you define it, the relationship?
I would call it a good friend, a curmudgeonly friend.
So it's kind of like, Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh or something. and how they go through one particular day. Why did you create these two opposites?
Yes, I love that framing, because for me, while they are two distinct characters, one being Giddy, who's just, you know, a bubble, totally effusive, and this bird that's kind of easy to box up, like, ugh, he's just kvetching all the time. I think, at least for me, the reality is we all have those tendencies within ourselves. And they're not super easy to box up even when we want to. And so sometimes I feel like Giddy and I'm like, oh, it's sunny outside, let's seize the day. And other times I just want to curl up into a ball. And so all of that lives inside of me. And I think one thing that's pertinent to that conversation, I was sharing an early version with my brother, who's very kvetch-like, and he was telling me, you know, I really connect with kvetch because he's not acting this way just because he's cranky. He's acting this way because he's a bit of a realist. Like, he sees clouds in the sky, so he's trying to plan for rain. He's really trying to take care of his best friend, Giddy. And I loved that framing. Like, people don't tend to just be cranky for the sake of it. There may be something deeper rooted down there. And I think that's also a good framing for kids to kind of think about why and exploring their emotions in that way.
So in the course of the story, again, you don't buy a kid's book because you haven't read it, I think, by the way. I think usually you read it through and you say, this would be great for, you know, little Sammy or whomever. So I hope I'm not giving away too much, but over the course
no,
of it,
go for it,
they trade roles, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, towards the end, events happen that make it so that Giddy is just totally down in the dumps. This one thing she was hoping to surprise or be friends with blows up in her face, which gives her friends an opportunity to kind of perk up a bit and take care of her. And so I was hoping this book would kind of be a springboard for kids too, to think about, you know, when are times that I can kind of get out of my own worldview or get out of my personality patterns to show up for a friend and love on them in a way that may be supportive? What are ways that I can try things a little bit differently? So I think, you know, we think of differences kind of static, like I have brown hair and you have blonde hair. I like purple and you like yellow. But I think it's nice to recognize like our tendencies, the things we care about, the way we approach the world change. And that's a good thing. And our differences should be really celebrated and honored.
Which of your kids shows up in the book?
Oh, why you got to do that to me, though?
Because I'm Jewish, you know. You always have to ask the hard questions. Isn't that the point of it all?
Okay, so I guess this is a bit of a weird tick I realize I'm sharing now, and I haven't shared, but I haven't even let my kids read the book yet because it hasn't come out, and I've had these, you know, fold and gather copies, and I've been a little bit, this is my first picture book, a few more are under contract, and I've been nervous to share with them, you know, of anyone else, and I think, to answer your question, when I do share with them, I imagine they will both see a whole lot of themselves in each character, though. I will say I have one kid, Manu, who's 2.5 and is just like the goofiest of goofy little humans. And I just see so much of that, you know, ebullient joy that Giddy has in him.
So I know a little bit about this industry. You don't meet your illustrator usually. It's always like it's almost like it's two different, I don't know, continents or something. Sometimes it is different continents. How did you get paired up? Tell us a little bit about that process.
Yes, I think that is such a hidden secret of, kids literature, is that the author and the illustrator are not in cahoots for the most part. So I got so lucky to work with my editor at S&EM, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And, you know, we talked about it was important for both of us that the illustrator also be Jewish, just as a way to kind of enrich the story from a different perspective. And so she was able to come across Ariel Landy, the illustrator, whose work is just, I just cannot wait for folks to dive into this. And I had no idea how she would conceptualize these characters. And to start seeing early drafts that popped in my inbox, I felt like, I mean, this is a story I've written, you know, for a year and I dreamed of. And then it feels like when you see the way she breathes life into them, it's like meeting them for the first time. I was totally overwhelmed by it. It's such a gift. You know, other authors that kind of warned me there's some anxiety in seeing those images the first time. Like,
yeah,
is it going to be
sure.
What you want? What if it's, yeah, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you have some idea in your head about what it looks like, right? You must.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it was the approach for me was like, think of it like a gift. Like, it is, how amazing is it that someone is investing their time and energy and creativity into adding their own imagination into the story? And the way she dreamed it up is just like delicious. I just cannot get enough of the characters. This little hat, like Kvetch's little yellow hat. Oh, just love every bit of it. So I'm just so grateful. And I can't wait for kids to pick their favorite bits as well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's almost kind of like Kvel and Kvetch are the two characters. I don't want to overdo the Yiddish, but it seemed to me like that, no?
Yes, I could. I was thinking, actually, the original draft that I submitted to the editor did not have a Yiddish name for Giddy. And so she was thinking, like, oh, you really gotta consider what could the name be. And that was the first thing, like, energetically, Kvel was coming up for me. But
yeah,
that didn't feel like a great little girl name. So I went with Giddle, which is actually a family name. And I loved that Giddy, you know, short for Giddle, Giddle meaning good, but also Giddy makes you think of Giddy, G-I-D-D-Y.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's pretty perfect. So
great, great, great homophony there between languages. Very nice. In creating the book, it takes a year. I think people don't understand. You know, you pick up a kid's book, you read it to your kid, it takes 5 minutes. You then read it again six more times. And you think, like, how long can it take to write something like this?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that process.
Sure. And it's different for everyone. But, I mean, that process is wild. So, you know, you write your manuscript, which could take, you know, your first draft may take you a few days. It may take you a few months. And the real magic for me is in revision. So it's collaborating with other folks that kind of point out what isn't working, consistencies, and certainly connecting with kids and saying, what do kids think? What do they latch onto? So that whole process can take, you know, infinite amounts of time. I have stories that I'm sitting on that I've written years and years ago that may see the light of day at some point. So anyway, that drafting process is one thing. Then you submit and go through that, you know, if you have an agent, you go through the process of submitting to an editor. And when they finally make an offer and you do the deal and you sign the contract, then your next round of edits could take up to a year.
Yeah.
And then from there, they're working to find that illustrator, working with art direction, binding, all the work that goes into making it an actual book. So from the time that I signed the contract, which was a year after I wrote the book, it's going to be about 2 years until it hits the shelf. So that's 3 years since I wrote it, which many other people go, oh, that's so fast, you're so lucky. You know, could sound wild to someone outside the industry.
No, I it is an incredibly, sometimes excruciatingly long process.
Mm-hmm.
I might also add that if you got paid on an hourly basis, you probably make more working at Walmart.
You could probably make what?
You could probably make more money working at Walmart. On an hourly basis.
Which is why you have to just love the storytelling. And there are also some really amazing opportunities once you've written a book, you know, which is the joy, of course, is in the writing, but also like getting to see kids laugh and like giggle and tell their own stories. And mm-hmm. ideally for me, you know, this book isn't just for Jewish kids, but it's for other kids that have their own languages. And this is an opportunity for them to, you know, say like, oh, listen to Spanish for that also makes me feel so connected to my roots. And so there are some opportunities to speak in schools and synagogues and bookstores, and I think that makes it a little bit more realistic to make a living
doing this sort
of work.
So the final question is, okay, so where do they go next, Gideon Kvetch? What's the next Gideon Kvetch book? Isn't that how it works?
Oh, see, I need to give you my editor's contact info. We got to get this going.
happy to talk to your editor. I'll schmooze him, no problem. Or her, probably.
Serious schmoozing. No, I'm already dreaming up tons of possibilities. But first, let's just see how this launch goes, August 31st. And hopefully kids and their caretakers, you know, fall in love with these characters and that they play some role in their life in a way that future stories become a little bit more realistic.
I guess that wasn't the final question. So what was the most fun part about this for you?
Oh, what a great one. I truly, without sounding too sappy, I mean, this is a dream come true. I've written ever since I could write. I've loved storytelling forever. And so just, I think the idea that something that was percolating in my brain, something that was born from my love for my grandfather, is now going to be in the hands of strangers. And like, you've read this book, and that's such a, you know, beautiful gift to me. And just getting to kind of bear witness to the entire process for me, I'm a little bit stunned by it. So maybe I'll have a better, more cohesive answer once it's out in the world. But for now, I'm just a little bit taken aback by what a gift this whole process has been.
That's lovely. It's great to hear that. It's kind of a Shehecheyanu moment.
Mm.
By the way, is Kvetch your grandfather?
Oh, just go right to the heart of it. You know, I don't think, if anything, Giddy is my grandfather. And days like this morning when I'm waking up with a crying four-year-old, potentially I am Kvetch. I hope that...
Yeah, yeah. I remember those days well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You never forget them.
You never forget. So I like to think there's a bit of Gideon Kvetch in all of us, certainly in all of us Jewish folk that could connect to this sort of language and these characters.
I want to thank Caroline Cusin-Pritchard for a wonderful visit here on Two Jewish. The book is called Gideon Kvetch. And it will be everywhere. Tell us, where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. My website is CarolineCusinPritchard.com. And I also have a fun little Instagram page where I post about books that I love, particularly books from authors that have previously been marginalized in publishing. And that's Caroline Pritchard Writes.
Thank you so much. And best of luck.
So
I think it'll be a terrific success.
I appreciate the time.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue, well, newish, in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, high holy day services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. You can also join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them, preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We will continue to hold our services both live and with full music by virtual experience, in person, and also on Facebook Live. All of our Adult Education Academy classes and our outreach classes are live and on Zoom. You can access that by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes program are available in person and on Zoom in blended format. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, life cycles, ceremonies, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services on Facebook. Go to beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, beitsimchatucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Janice Chalovich, discussing combating pancreatic cancer among Ashkenazic Jews through the Purple Pansies nonprofit. Our playout this morning comes for, well, the upcoming Jewish High Holy Days, when you can come join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Go to beitsimchatucson.org to sign up for beautiful, meaningful, musical High Holy Day experiences for $57.82. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. for services and Torah reading, or Facebook Live, our Facebook page for services. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.